talk about on 702 ABC Sydney and ABC New South Wales.
It's that time again, 11:05 on your local ABC, time for Saturday Talk About. And joining me around the table this morning, first up is James O'Brien. He is the content director, or I always thought you were the program director,
oh,
James.
It's all very modern now, it's content.
Content
we direct now.
Oh, well, very good. He is the content director for 702 ABC Sydney. Hello, James, and welcome.
Hi, Ange.
Very lovely to have you here. John Cleary, my old friend and regular guest, and he's the presenter of Sunday Nights. And so do you not, you know, describe yourself as being from the religious department anymore?
We're the religion unit.
The religion
days.
Unit.
Yes, we cover this. You know, when a content director speaks of depth, religion unit speaks of sort of breadth and transcendence.
Quite, oh, very nice. I love that. And also joining us is our colleague Justin Huntsdale. He is a producer and presenter from the ABC Western Plains in Dubbo. Hello there, Justin.
G'day, Angela. Also answer to online content director.
Online. See all these fancy
CDs.
Titles.
PDs have been replaced by CDs.
CDs.
CDs have gone, but they're back.
Well, CDs have actually been replaced by MP3s, haven't
That's
they?
That's right.
Justin, how's things been in Dubbo this week?
Not too bad. A little bit of rain out here, which is always nice to see. But, yeah, I think a little bit more is still needed.
Well, isn't that hysterical? You talk about it, never rains, it pours. Mm. It's a funny place, isn't it, Australia? While one part is absolutely drowning, you know, the other part is dry as a bone. I remember last week with the floods in the North Coast, down in the Riverina, there were these hideous dust storms with this red dust all whipped up by these very strong winds. So, James O'Brien, first up, as we all know, finally the clean-up has started on the North Coast and the mid-North Coast. The state government set up 4 recovery centres, sort of your one-stop shop for flood victims. So have you been involved in the flood coverage?
Look, very much so. I mean, the interesting thing about of the 4 of us involved in Talk About today, 3 of us have worked in Lismore. So and you, Ange, have a very strong connection to Lismore, as do I. Going back many, well, I was born and raised.
Yeah,
and
you're spent, a Lismore boy, aren't you?
And you spent last weekend actually in the North Coast yourself doing flood broadcasting.
Yeah, well, I helped out a little bit because the poor dears were so exhausted after their non-stop rolling coverage of the floods that they needed a little bit of, you know, fresh meat in there just so that they could take a break.
Now, of all the floods, the thing about sort of growing up in the North Coast is I remember there have been several years of my life where we've had 4 or 5 floods, one after the other. Mm-hmm. 74 was probably the best example of that, but even 87, 88, I think there were 4 or 5 floods in a row. And the thing about North Coast floods is you kind of get used to them, but the interesting thing which has happened is that in the last 20 or 30 years, an awful lot of people have moved to the North Coast who've never been through floods before.
Yeah.
What was it like the first time? Because you were there for 74, weren't you?
I was there for 74, which was a huge flood. And, you know, well, I was completely unprepared. I drove an old Holden at that time, an old FB Holden, which is a big old heavy thing. I didn't know anything about parking at the top of the hill so that, you know, you didn't have to kind of get bogged trying to get out of your driveway. It was a huge lesson, you know. Yeah. I had to buy gumboots, of course. It was a huge lesson. I was completely cut off where I lived. I couldn't get places. You do learn, don't you?
And absolutely, yeah.
The thing I loved is there are businesses in town, in Lismore in particular, who are so used to it, like the Mecca Cafe, which I remember has these wonderful pictures and mirrors on its walls, and they're all hung by hinges so that they can actually lift it up and latch them up out of the way of the water.
Yeah. Look, the Winsome Hotel in North Lismore, it was up until a couple of years ago when they had a makeover, they used to actually have inside the pub a flood marker.
Yeah.
And it was actually like the feet on the wall. And they had lines, 74, 56, 54. And they actually took it away a couple of years ago.
Oh, did
I was
they?
A bit sad when
That's
I saw it
shame,
go.
That's a shame, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like one of those height things on the back of the door that you have when you were a kid. You know, here you are when you were tiny. And I don't know if you had one
of those. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's right.
I think the other thing that the flood show and the recent fires in Victoria is the way the ABC, and James, you know about this, has transformed itself to have a sort of second layer of sort of emergency services, ABC consciousness throughout. I mean, we've restructured the ABC, and the public are aware of when the fires come along or the floods come along, but they're not quite aware of what the level of sophistication that's gone into restructuring the whole joint.
Well, I can tell you that it was interesting. I mean, my sister rang me up. I spoke to my sister who lives in South Lismore on Friday morning, and I said, oh, how's it going? As I said, is it going to be a big flood or is it going to be just, is the river up? And she said, look, I've turned on the radio and there's nothing on the radio. And I said, what? She said, nothing on 2LM at all. I said, turn over to the ABC. And, of course, she turned over to the ABC and there was extensive coverage. I think we were on air for four or five days, non-stop.
24 hours a day. Look, it was a magnificent coverage, a magnificent effort, I have to say, by the staff of the ABC North Coast and the Mid-North Coast. They just keep it going. And you know that there are people who are marooned, who are completely isolated, and the only contact they have, they've been cut off, their power is off, they can't really go anywhere unless they've got a boat, and all they've got is a tranny with a couple of batteries in it.
That's right.
And they're listening to the ABC.
Well, I remember hearing from one woman who called in on Friday afternoon when I was on air with John Morrison, and she said, look, the power's gone off. We've got no power at all, and all I have is the radio. There's nothing. And they were on they weren't on town water as well, so they couldn't even pump.
No.
The interesting thing, of course, now is that the recovery operation has been underway. John Morrison from Statewide Drive has actually been on the North Coast this week. He's broadcast from three locations, mostly around the mid-North Coast, just to find out how the recovery process has been going on. And amongst the many people he spoke to was a woman called Nancy, who is from the local Red Cross.
Because a lot of people are in this area. It's all up, about 3,000 in the town and about 5,000 all around.
Yeah.
So the majority of those people would be affected one way or another, to greater or lesser degree, by the
particularly the people, you know, down on the lower parts of the town itself and the outlying areas.
Yeah.
You know, you take Harwood, Palmer's Island. We have to send food out to a few people out there. But it's one of those things that you do and try and help people. But it's... The thing is, they're all so grateful. You know, we've done this. Every time I see them, it's hugs, you know, because you've done this. But it's been good to get them sorted out, you know.
Yeah. Oh, it is indeed. And what happens now? I mean, the work continues. We've heard from the SES, from Ron Rushton, about the clean-up that's ahead. But there's still, you're helping a lot of the people readjust as
well. That's what we've got to do, in trying to get people to somebody to... see that they get their Centrelink, what docs can do for them. Some of them are going to need help moving stuff in their places. Some of their caravans mightn't be able to be used again. You know? So there's that
exactly
thing.
Right.
We're then the situation today where the Salvation Army have got settees and chairs and stuff under their building.
Yeah.
And we couldn't get anybody to take it to the recycle centre. So we're going to have a workshop in a couple of weeks' time and clean it all up then.
It's Nancy from the Red Cross at McLean. I mean, the other interesting thing, I think, too, is the impact on business. I mean, you talked about people putting up stock and all those sorts of things. We spoke on air to a mate of mine, Kerry, who's on the board of Norco, and he talked about they just put all these crops in, you know, under 3 or 4 feet of water. He said it's impossible at that stage, when we spoke to him last week, to estimate the economic cost, but the economic cost as well as the personal cost.
What about the poor dairy farmers? I really feel for them, because a lot of them were out of power for days on end. And, of course, they all use automatic milking. They use milking machines now.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, no.
What about the poor cow?
The poor cow?
Well, mastitis. Well, that's what... Kerry's a dairy farmer as well, and he talked about mastitis as being a really big issue. He said, luckily, out of Woodlawn, he was up high enough so that they could still milk.
Yeah.
But, I mean, mastitis... with the udders is a big issue.
Very, very sad. Justin, I don't suppose you have that, you know, the flood problem in Dubbo, do you?
We're dreaming about that. Right? No, it is interesting to listen to Nancy, and having worked there for 3 months at the ABC Lismore office, and it was only 3 months, but in that period of time, we managed to cop 2 significant hailstorms, which caused an enormous amount of damage, and a tornado. Now, that was just 3 months. It's just incredible the sort of resilience that these people on the North Coast have. And as James mentioned, when you're a local there, you sort of just learn to put up with massive weather events like this. And I guess that's the trade-off. They live in such a beautiful part that as a cost of that, they have to put up with some pretty unfortunate weather sometimes.
I think that's probably true.
Now, the interesting thing about the whole clean-up operation is obviously you've got people on the ground like your Red Cross, your Salvos and so on. But they brought Ken Moroney in, the former New South Wales Police Commissioner, to actually supervise the clean-up operation. Now, the interesting thing about Ken is that he arrived in Lismore as a police officer at about the age of 27 in 1973. And he was in Lismore between 73 and 81. And in that time, 8 years, he had about 11 floods to contend with. So he remembers...
he was there for the 74 flood too.
Anyway, look, he said to me, he obviously had some responsibilities to worry about now, but he also told Adam Spencer on 702 ABC Sydney Breakfast how much he remembers 1974.
It still lives vividly in my mind because it's not only the speed with which the water rises, but it's the speed with which it also moves. And it can be quite frightening. And as we know from past experiences, it not only creates structural damage, it takes lives as well.
So what are the priorities going to be in the rebuilding and recovery phase, Ken?
My entire job, as I see it, is about the recovery process. I see myself as very much the fellow holding a lot of keys and holding the keys to the doors that open into state government, to local government, and into federal government, and working through those various agencies with the affected communities.
That's Kim Maroney.
So many of these people, in those disaster situations, you just feel you need a go-to person, don't you?
A fix-it
guy.
You go
back to Darwin and Major General Stretton.
That's right, yeah.
And then you go to former police commissioner in Victoria.
Peter Cosgrove.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and it's just that if people can feel there is somebody there who just acts as the focus, and they know it's symbolic to some extent, but you know that if I get to that point, then other things will flow out from
me. Ken said his job was to actually go and talk to locals and find out, and then if he's got a sense that the locals need X, Y, and Z, he can go to the state government and say, this is what they need.
And let's hope that, you know, that they listen. I wonder why they built Lismore there in the first place. Don't you, James?
No.
It's like the bottom of a saucer, for goodness sake. It's the wrong place.
I'm a proud Southie boy, let me tell you.
It's not called the Wok for nothing, James.
That's exactly
right. It's the dairy farming days, and it is beautiful down
there. Yeah, but on the banks of the river, come on. Couldn't they have gone up the hill a bit? It's 16 past 11. You're listening to Saturday Talk About.
G'day, Macca here. I'm taking Australia all over on the road for another Say G'day tour. Don't miss it. This year we'll be starting in Victoria, visiting towns and broadcasting in Kinglake on the 31st of May. We'd love to see you. If you can't be there, join me right here. Don't miss us on the road for another Say G'day tour. For details, you can go to abc.net.au/AustraliaAllOver.
Get on with it, Macca.
Yeah, off you go, Macca. It's 17 past 11. You're on your local ABC, and this is Saturday Talk About. Thank you so much for joining us around the table. My name's Angela Caterns. James O'Brien is with us from 702. Justin Huntsdale is with us from the ABC Western Plains in Dubbo. And John Cleary is with us from Sunday Nights and the Religious Unit. Now, John, for the Sydney Writers' Festival, very interesting speaker. Richard Holloway.
Richard Holloway was in town. Now, Richard Holloway is almost, he's been sort of come caricatured around the world. He's the bishop who sort of has doubts about God.
God.
I mean, we were reflecting.
Has he always, or has this come upon him of late?
This has come to him over time. He is probably one of the most academically and practically qualified people in terms of divinity in the world. I mean, not only was he extraordinarily high academic qualifications at some of the great universities, at Oxford, Cambridge, sort, but also he was head of the Episcopal Church in Scotland. He was Bishop of Edinburgh. And he's come to the conclusion after a long life that this whole religious thing is a bit problematic.
So he's declared himself an agnostic, hasn't he?
Well, he says he's an expectant agnostic.
Well, that's very interesting. So can you just describe? I've actually tried to look the difference between the atheist and the agnostic, and it's a very fine line.
Well, the agnostic is somebody who... You have hard agnostics and soft agnostics. Hard agnostics basically say, look, we've got no reason to believe, so even though we can't prove it, why bother? Soft agnostics say, well, look, we can't prove it, but that's the whole point about religion. It's about faith. So you get this strand in agnosticism, and I think he would be generally a sort of soft agnostic. But he does have real reservations about institutional religion, and he's going to be our guest tomorrow night, and I think people are going to be rather stirred, one way or t'other, by what Richard Holloway has to say. Here's a sample.
Why did they crucify Jesus? Precisely because he challenged the way institutional religion becomes its own purpose, its own end. It's created in order to achieve good things for people: forgiveness, compassion, justice, peace, gentleness, and all of those things. And you need an institution to deliver those things. That the great sociologist Weber coined a very inelegant but actually apt phrase. He described this process as the routinization of charisma. The charisma is the gift, the thing Jesus brought, the vision, the ideal, and you need an institution to carry it through time so that it doesn't die, so that it isn't lost. But the law of institutions is that the vehicle that you choose to deliver the purpose ends up being more important than the purpose that it's delivering. And that's what's happened to the church. The church exists in order to exist. I don't know what it is that gets invested in theory. It gets invested in dogma and in doctrine, when in fact Jesus himself reduced it all to the test of love. The letters of John say the same thing: God is love, and love in a sense proves God. The great parable at the end of Matthew's Gospel, chapter 25, it's not the people who said Lord, Lord, and who said the creeds and who had the perfect doctrine. It's the people who probably had none of that. The atheists are out delivering soup to the homeless, who are visiting prisoners. That's the gospel. That's the purity of the thing. And it's all bread of pity. It all comes from this ability to put yourself into the shoes and into the undershirt of someone who's having a tough time.
That sort of voice. Gets it, doesn't he? Yeah. Really whack.
And I could listen to that voice for days on end. It's so cute. I want to put myself into the undershirt of someone who's having a hard time.
Well, I think the interesting thing is that, I mean, you talked about how radical it might sound that someone of faith is questioning things, but I mean, who does not believe in something who hasn't at some point honestly deep down thought, look, I wonder if I am right about this, you know?
Yeah.
I'm reminded, there's a great quote in a book by Caroline Jones a couple of years ago, and she said, for a long, long time, we thought that seeing is believing. Now a lot of people realise that believing is seeing, which I thought was really quite a wonderful quote. Mm. And the other thing I'm reminded of, too, is that episode of Yes, Prime Minister. It's being replayed on... It was replayed last weekend, actually, on pay TV, and I saw it's the one where they're looking for a replacement Archbishop of Canterbury, and they decide that belief in God is an optional extra when it comes to.
And I think this Holloway was the caricature that they based it on. But Holloway is demonstrating what he says is actually a profound biblical truth, and it's not just a Christian truth. The whole truth of the Bible, he says, is anti-institutional religion. It starts with Moses basically beating up on those Hebrews who were building a golden calf. It then goes through the prophets who said, don't talk to me about your rituals. What are you doing about the widows and orphans? And along comes Jesus and does the same thing. He says, so I have a problem with the way people express religion and express their belief in God.
Well, that's very interesting. And so therefore, you know, I get the impression then that most moderate Christians could call themselves agnostics, and it's really only the fundamentalists who know that there is a God.
And Holloway does have a problem both in secular life and religious life with those people who claim to know absolutely. And his book is called Between the Monster and the Saint, and it's a reflection on how certain we can be about anything and how certainty actually contains the real seeds of evil. Fascinating man. It'll be wonderful fun. Tomorrow night.
I look forward to it immensely. That's the Sunday night program with John Cleary and his wonderful interview with Richard Holloway. What time is it on?
Oh, we'll be on at 11 o'clock with Richard Holloway.
Tomorrow night. Awesome.
Saturday Talk About.
Angela Caturns is my name. James O'Brien is with us. John Cleary and Justin Huntsdale is the voice from the Western Plains of New South Wales, from Dubbo. So now, Justin, tell us about Charlie Bartley.
Well, there's virtually not a person in Dubbo left now who doesn't know the name Charlie Bartley. But if I asked you that question in maybe 2008, you might not have known him. He's a young boy from Dubbo, grew up here, went to school here and left in 2008 to pursue a dance career. Now, when he came back, which was last week, he received a hero's welcome and a mayoral reception.
Wow.
What he did was ended up coming second in the national So You Think You Can Dance TV show. This is one of the more popular kind of Channel 10 reality TV shows. And Charlie auditioned, beat thousands of people to make it down to the top 20. And then it's a process of where they get paired up with a female in the competition as well. And
yes, I remember Charlie. He was just pipped by a young woman, wasn't he?
Yeah, Talia.
That's right. Yeah.
And so they end up drawing a dance style out of a hat, and then they have to perform that style on the Sunday night show. And in the first week, Charlie actually pulled out the hip-hop style, which is his kind of favourite style. So he hardly had to learn anything for it, which was, I guess, the ideal start. And I think that's one of the things that really set him up for the competition, because he ended up delivering this fantastic routine, and suddenly everyone took notice of this young guy from Dubbo. And as I mentioned, one of his first commitments when he came back to Dubbo last week was a meal reception, and I caught up with Charlie in the studio recently.
Just looking out and seeing all the family and friends from the past, and you know, it's a real eye opener to how far I've come, and all the role models and stuff that have helped me along the way. I put all the lessons I've learned into play during the show, so it's been a big whirlwind so far.
Because when you left, you were just the Charlie Bartley, the good local dancer, and you've come back as a household name. That must be weird.
Yes, it is very weird. You never kind of... I don't think I'm any different to when I left, so I just danced around on a stage for 3 months. It doesn't actually register that I've been, you know, on TV for that long. So it's very, very weird.
What sort of physical condition were you in at that point at the end?
Pretty exhausted. towards the end, it was like I was a machine. We all were, especially the top four. We were just, it was just kind of get through the days, because by that time we'd had 2 days rest in 3 months of 7 days a week, and towards the end it was 12 hours a day. So basically you're just trying to find the energy from somewhere. It was eat whatever you could and sleep whenever you could, you know, 15 minutes here, 15 minutes there, just trying to get that amount of energy to keep pushing on. Because I know, and no one saw this except for the crowd that was there, but when we finished the jive, me and Talia, I was standing there like, and my legs were absolute juice, like I'd given absolutely everything I had. And I had to, and when they went, and we'll be back after this break, I had to go to my knees, because I was like, my quads couldn't hold me up anymore.
There he is, Charlie Bartley, and that's how he was at the end of the competition.
Oh, I hate it when your quads can't hold you up anymore.
I was listening to that anecdote thinking, yeah, I can imagine how hard that was, but really, I've never worked that hard in my life.
Is he back home to Dubbo to live, Justin?
Just to visit friends and family. He's kind of got a professional dance career cooking in Sydney now, a bit of teaching, and he's looking to get into musical theatre and a little bit of TV presenting and stuff like that. This kid's only 19.
Is he?
And one of the things that I asked Charlie about was, because there was a local business in Dubbo, a juice shop, that ran a competition where if you could dance like Charlie for 20 seconds in the middle of the Dubbo food court, you would get a free juice.
That's cashing in, isn't it?
I know. And I asked him, is it weird to be a 19-year-old bloke and there is a major business in Dubbo running a competition for other people to imitate you?
Yeah.
And I think he's handled the fame pretty well, actually.
It's one of the things that disturbs me, though, you know, about the whole reality show phenomena. And it's one of the things, interestingly, that Richard Holloway alludes to. He says there's something deep in our human psyche. It's about the Schadenfreude stuff, where you delight in other people's disaster. And he says there's an aspect of that in reality television. And you get it, a little hint of it there coming through, where they push people to disaster's edge. And the producers are not really concerned with the well-being of the contestants. Mm. They're not concerned to elevate the contestants. They're concerned to push the contestants far enough to the edge where we, the viewers, get some sort of delight in seeing whether they're going to crash or not.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I don't know if that's true of this show. What do you think, Justin?
I think that, talking from Charlie, they do look after them reasonably well, but I agree with John in saying that they do push them hard, and that's part of the competition. I mean, can you submit yourself to this competition, go 3 months of not eating much, not sleeping much, and still get through it all? In Charlie's case, the answer was yes, but I mean, we have seen people crack. And on that subject too, we do see people quite critical of reality TV shows, particularly ones like Big Brother, where people are thrown into a house and they're made famous really through no other way of, I mean, they're not doing anything especially important. I guess the thing that separates
Charlie and the dance show he went on, it is largely skill-based. And I guess whether you like reality TV or not, you can't deny that he has been through a fair bit over the last 3 months.
It's funny, though. Everything gets called reality TV now. And to me, this sounds like a talent show.
It is a talent show,
isn't
it?
This sounds like Johnny Young and Young Talent Time. I mean, they talk about reality shows, and it's a documentary. And it's really interesting that sometimes this reality tag is applied to a lot of things. And it's actually, I don't watch this show in particular, but I mean that recent phenomenon with Susan Boyle, you know, when she gets out there and sings and she's got this beautiful voice, I mean, there were tears everywhere, people thinking, great, isn't this wonderful?
Yeah, the reality frame of reference, though, it's about the way in which it's done, in which you've got three judges up there and one you know is up there deliberately to rip the person's guts out, no matter who they are.
Yeah.
And I think Susan Boyle is one of those. I'm still waiting for the Susan Boyle mask to be ripped off and then she is, you know, this glamorous 24-year-old blonde or something will bomb out.
Beyonce underneath there.
It's interesting, the other thing you mentioned, Justin, about sort of him being in town. And I remember years ago living in Wagga, and Michael Slater returned to Wagga after he and Mark Taylor got that double century in the Ashes, and it was all very exciting. And I watched Michael walk into the wine bar in Fitzmaurice Street in Wagga, and everyone turned their heads. Now, 6 months earlier, no one would have turned their heads. Yeah. What was it like for Charlie going back? Did he find it was a bit odd going back having everyone looking at him?
It was, and that's the thing. Like, he left here as an unknown, and he hasn't come back since when he left. He's been doing this full-time dance course. So he left, having walked down the street and have no one recognise him, to coming back. I saw him out at the pub on Friday night, and he was accosted every time he went to the bar, having photos and everything like that.
And the mayoral reception, for goodness sake.
Isn't it great for a 19-year-old to be there? The mayor said that it's the most amount of young people that have ever been present at a mayoral reception.
Fantastic. Good on you, Justin. You're listening to Saturday Talk About. It's just past 11:30. Time for some music now. This is Big Bad Voodoo Daddy.
The richer you get, remember, the more that you're aching to make, it's the dough you forget the government takes. It's true. Oh, what are you to do? You multiply, but you can't take it with you when you die. How big can you get? Can you get? Can you get? The bigger you get, the more you upset. The more you upset makes the more that you fret. How big can you get? How big can you get? Say, Jack, you could never wear more than one suit at a time. And wear one pair of shoes, that ain't no crime. What do you want to beat, bub? Guggenheim? A hot dog on the car, that cat a dime. You can try to be a duke or a grand marquis. Well, you see the latest movies the same as he. They all listen to the radio and all for free. I'm asking you, bub, how big can you be? How big can you get? Can you get? Can you get? How big can you get? Aren't you big enough yet? So why are you stretching up talent and talk? For the bigger you get, the harder you fall. Oh, how rich can you get? Can you get? Can you get? You're gonna regret, yes, the richer you get. Remember, the more that you're aching to make, it's the dough you forget the government takes. It's true. Oh, what are you to do? You multiply, but you can't take it with you when you die. How big can you get? Can you get? Can you get? The bigger you get, the more you upset. The more you upset makes the more that you fret. How
How big can you get? How big can you get?
Fantastic big band sound. It's a Cab Calloway song performed there by Big Bad Voodoo Daddy. How Big Can You Get is the name of the song and also the album.
Angela, I've got to say that the way you swing around the studio, I tell you, so you think you can dance? Just should see Ange.
Not to be confused with Big Bad Barry Hall, who I think is also working on a similar composition.
It's 25 to 12.
Saturday Talk About.
We're in the midst of Saturday Talk About. Thank you so much for joining us. Angela Caturns is my name. James O'Brien from 702 ABC Sydney. He's the content director. He's with us, as is John Cleary from Sunday Nights on your local ABC. And Justin Hunsdale also joins us from the ABC Western Plains in Dubbo. I hope you've all washed your hands before you've come into the studio.
Well, see the can of Glen 20 over there? That's ready to go. You can always, you can spray as if you are microphones. Concerned.
Got my face mask in my pocket.
Yeah, very good. I saw a sign over by the sink in the kitchen here that I haven't seen before about make sure that you wash your hands.
They've
wash
gone up hands. In Dubbo as well.
Have
wash
they?
Your hands, mm. Gloria. Mm. Is that was the ad, wasn't it, from years ago? Wash your hands.
Wash your hands, somebody.
Yeah, Jeffrey. Wash your hands, Jeffrey.
It was Jeffrey.
But look, I mean, I can talk about two things here, one of which is what we've talked about on air, but the other thing is what we actually have to do here at the radio stations. And one of the things I've been doing this week in my off-air role is trying to work out what happens if, for example, any one of our radio stations in New South Wales is closed down. Because the health department can do that. You know, schools have been closed down. So what happens if, for example, our station in Dubbo...
What about if the station on the North Coast or the Mid-North Coast, where they're providing this valuable service to the floodbound?
So we're going to try and sit down and work that out. And for example, what happens if 702? What if it comes into the building in Ultimo and knocks out... Don't. What happens, for example, if the health department says there's a couple of cases of swine flu in the ABC building in Ultimo, the whole lot's closed down?
Yeah, do they close the building down or do they close down studio by studio?
Well,
they'd have to close the building down.
Well, I don't know, and that's, I guess, part of the uncertainty at the moment.
They just send everybody out on a cruise ship. That'd be good, wouldn't it? We all go for a nice cruise somewhere.
That'd be lovely.
Off to Tahiti, please, James.
And it was interesting. I mean, yesterday morning, on Friday morning on AM, the former head of Emergency Management Australia said, look, for these big things, we are pretty unequipped in Australia. You know, we think we're okay, but we're probably not. Then you've also got this idea that people die from the flu anyway. Mm. So why are we getting so excited
about
this?
And that's the real dilemma about the swine flu, isn't it? It's spreading as a pandemic, but its level of severity is not high. But you have to treat it as though it is high.
Yeah.
That really is the great conundrum, because businesses say, hang on, we're going to lose millions here for something that's mild.
Yeah. Yes, well, that's perhaps no worse than the yearly seasonal flu. Yes.
Mm. I heard on 702 Drive this week with Jennifer Byrne, Professor Raina McIntyre, who's from the University of New South Wales. She talked about the possibilities of what it might mean in Australia. She talked about the W effect, which means quite often these flus will come in and they'll be okay. You know, everyone will be fine. But then they go away and then they come back even stronger.
Mm.
And it was really interesting to hear her say that she thought, and so old Jennifer Byrne this week on 702 Drive, the worst was yet to come.
I think within a week to a couple of weeks, we'll see very widespread transmission and probably a peak of the epidemic by July or even in late June.
What, as soon as next month?
Yes.
A peak by the end of next month?
Or by July, yeah.
And what are your predictions in total numbers?
I think we could see anywhere between 10 to 30% of the Australian population getting sick.
And is this just the way these epidemics work, that it starts slowly and then just extrapolate, you know, basically...
That's right, and we can model the way it's going to unfold mathematically based on known parameters such as the infectious period, the incubation period, and the number of secondary cases caused by one primary case. So, and we've done that kind of modelling work, and you know, we have predicted that this is exactly how it will unfold.
Can it be contained at this point?
Look, I guess anything's possible, but I think it's unlikely. I think it's well and truly in the community, and I think for every confirmed case, there's probably somewhere between, you know, 3 to 10 unconfirmed cases out there that we haven't even picked up, and that's going to cause ongoing chains of transmission and make the epidemic grow.
That's Professor Raina McIntyre from the University of New South Wales, and her specialty is infectious diseases epidemiology.
That's very sobering comments of hers. So 10 to 30% of the population, so one of us, will likely come down with the swine flu.
Well, you've already started sneezing, Angela. So
it's going to be me. So yep. You feel okay now, Justin?
I'm feeling safe. So at least I'm not in the same room.
That's true, I suppose. But it's pretty sobering stuff, isn't it? I don't know whether to be worried or scared or just, you know, get on with it and not worry about it.
I think
it
you just
all.
Have to get on with it and not worry, because we know that that it's going to spread anyway, that all you do is take the same reasonable precautions you take every year with the flu, because we know that the level of severity at this stage is not one that one has to hit the panic button over. I think it's just reasonable caution.
Every year, people do die from the flu. I mean, older people in particular.
True. Yeah, that's
people
true.
Who are immune compromised, all those sorts of people who are at risk of the flu anyway are presumably at risk of this as well.
Yes, but see how we're all just a little bit worried. I'm worried my daughter is going to America next month, and I'm very worried about her. She's an asthmatic, so that immediately puts her into a slightly higher risk group.
Yeah.
I don't know whether to, you know, fit her out with some Tamiflu just in case. Not sure.
Give her a bunch of masks.
You get her some masks, all right then. It's 19 to 12.
Berkeley, California.
Oppenheimer, starring Sam Waterston, is now available on DVD. This three-disc set delves into the enigma that was J. Robert Oppenheimer, the American physicist often quoted as the father of the atomic bomb. He was the leader of the Manhattan Project, the U.S. research team tasked with the development of a viable atomic weapon, which brought a devastating end to the Second World War. Oppenheimer, available now from ABC shops, centres and online.
Thank you for tuning in to Talk About this Saturday morning. There's been a lot of talk recently, hasn't there, about sport and about ethics, and you can throw religion into the mix, and John Cleary has a topic to discuss again.
Yes, tomorrow night's a big night. We're going to dip right in our first hour talk back tomorrow night with ethics, sport and religion, because recently you've had all this controversy about sportsmen and sex and, you know, whether... Now, institutional religion has been also accused of sort of doing the wrong thing over sex over recent years. I mean, it's been...
Yes.
So you're dealing with two areas that have strong institutional holds on people,
yes.
You know, sport being Australia's true religion,
and
also associated with building people's character, shaping their character. Mm. You know, you have the old, you know, why does every sporting coach say to the kids, you know, sport will shape the character of Australia. Now, what sort of characters are we shaping? And what sort of place? Where do kids find ethical models these days? Now, within the sporting community and the religion community, there's an interesting crossover. In the lead up to the Olympics, you had all these American athletes saying, you know, well, Jesus is going to help me win gold and, you know, and various... That's one aspect of the whole religion sport thing. The other aspect of it is, though, the culture that is shaped by trying to institute an ethical environment. And we've got three people who come at it three different ways. Joanna Peters, the of the Matildas, the Australian women's soccer team.
Yeah.
Brendan Nottle, who is the chaplain to the most famous football club in Australia, the Collingwood AFL club, and Nick Farr-Jones. Now, here's a little of Nick, just in the traditional sports mode.
at the end of the day, now that I've sort of pulled back from the international rugby scene, I'm delighted that I was involved in a team situation where you've really got to have an ability to get on with your mates. When you tour with your 30 mates for 6 and 7 weeks around the world, you've got to be able to get on. You've got to be fairly tolerant. You've got to know that you've got to be sensitive to people's needs. At the same time, you've got to have discipline. When I was growing up playing rugby, I didn't really idolise anyone. I didn't really watch the test matches. It wasn't till sort of my last couple of years at Newington and then going into Sydney University when I got serious on rugby and I started to go to the tests and take an interest in international rugby. But, you know, I can never really remember setting goals that, you know, I want to be an international player, I want to be a Wallaby, I want to captain the team.
Mm. You hear all those bits, the team building, the responsibility for my mates, it's all about character.
Yes.
Is the word underlying that. Yet both sport and religion are in question at the moment. Brendan Nottle, it's done some remarkable things at Collingwood. Brendan's a salvo. So he's got guys on the Collingwood football team coming out on their emergency van overnight, working with homeless kids and street kids.
Right.
Now, there's a completely different approach to the old moralising approach. This isn't about character building, it's about character formation.
You know?
It's about helping shape who we are.
Well, I mean, it's sad, isn't it, that a lot of the young footballers who are the stars of today are very unformed, you know. They're sort of plucked from schools. They haven't necessarily had much of a grounding in any of these things. And they become stars, you know. The spotlight is thrown on them. And then we complain about them not being good role models. Models for our kids.
I don't know if anybody saw it on the other night. William McInnes on Q&A made a terrific line where he said, when I was growing up in the 70s, the guy in the sports team, you know, your local league hero, was also the guy you could find painting your house on the weekend.
Mm.
They were embedded in the community.
Yeah.
These days they're not. They're taken straight out of the community, elevated to these colossal
heights.
Yeah,
that's exactly right.
And then all of a sudden have to be role models.
That's right, with very little life experience or lessons learned.
Yeah. And Justin, I mean, Justin, you would have seen particularly, I mean, so many of the players of all sporting codes are actually from the country, and quite often they're picked up at the age of 16 or 17, brought to Sydney, and sometimes kind of left to their own devices. And often don't return to those communities.
Absolutely, and there's a growing list. Obviously, Wagga's reputation for producing sports people is pretty well known. I think what you notice at a local level, particularly with rugby league and rugby union, they encourage them to have their own jobs outside the sport, and even at the highest level, the first grade, where some of the players do receive some sort of a match fee, pretty much everyone still has to work to put food on the table. And maybe if we saw that philosophy extended to some of the NRL or AFL teams, we might have a few less problems.
Mm. Good on you, Justin and John. That sounds
character
like another
formation
great
on
chat.
Sunday night, tomorrow night, and people can ring in. So if they want to talk to Brendan or Joanna or Nick, give us a call.
Yeah, excellent. You're tuned to Saturday Talk About with me, Angela Caterns, him, John Cleary, him, James O'Brien, and him in Dubbo, Justin Hunsdale. In just a moment, we are going to meet the recently crowned New South Wales Rural Woman of the Year. But first, another track. This is Van Morrison.
Brother, love is divine, and it's yours and it's mine. Have I told you lately that I love? Have I told you there's no one above you? Fill my heart with gladness, take away my sadness, ease my troubles, that's what you do.
Have I told you lately that I love you?
Oh, wonderful.
That's Van Morrison here on your local ABC. It's 8 to 12.
Hello, I'm Monica Atta. Join me and Stephen Wolfram on Sunday Profile this weekend. Wolfram is a computer genius who very quietly last week launched a new kind of computer search engine called Wolfram Alpha, an invention that aims to compute all the knowledge in the world. But will it replace Google? That's Stephen Wolfram, the brains behind Wolfram Alpha on Sunday Profile.
Sunday night from 9 on 702 ABC Sydney.
But right now you're tuned to Saturday Talk About. I'm Angela Caterns, James O'Brien is with us, John Cleary is with us, and Justin Hunsdale is with us at in the ABC studios in Dubbo. So Justin, tell us about Kim Curry.
This is a name that people across the Central West and the Western Plains may be familiar with. Kim's an Orange local, but over the last 25 years or so, she's been working with farmers around the region to help them promote their local food and wine. Obviously, Mudgee and Orange, massive wine-growing, grape-growing areas. And this week, she was down in Canberra to formally receive the New South Wales Rural Woman of the Year Award, which is a great achievement. Mm-hmm. One of the other things Kim's quite known for is introducing farmers markets to various places across the Central West. I know they're extremely popular here in Dubbo. Every first and third Saturday, I think it is, down in the Lions Park here. And I know from just going down there myself, it's growing every time, and there seems to be so many more people getting into it. And it's just one of these extra ways of kind of helping out farmers and minimising the distance that our food travels to get to us. And that's one of the big things that Kim has been dedicating time to lately. You might have heard of the 100-mile diet or some sort of distance, a small distance around where you live. Basically, it was pioneered by a Canadian couple, I believe, who vowed to only eat food from 100 miles.
Ah, so it's not necessarily...
There.
When you said the 100-mile diet, I thought it had something to do with having to, you know, run
100
miles.
Well,
500 miles.
To lose weight.
I don't think it'd be very popular.
No, but so the idea is that you only eat food that is produced within 100 miles of home.
Exactly, and this Canadian couple managed to do that for a year. Kim says that's probably a bit too much to ask, given how convenient a lot of the big supermarkets are around. She says if we could take our current consumption of, say, 3% of local food and try and up that to even just 10%, it would make a massive difference. But we caught up with her on the morning show this week, and she explained this diet a little more.
Well, one of the things that we've been doing in the Orange region, and the theme of this year's Food Week was the 100-mile diet, and that's encouraging people to think about where their food comes and eat food that comes from your local area. Now, we're taking that even further. We're looking at... we've got a project about the 100-mile platter lunches. Now, what Orange is looking at doing is being a template and supporting other regions like probably Dubbo and Mudgee in the first instance to create some events within the region and then also repeat those events in Sydney with guest regions during the Sydney International Food Festival. So what actually happened initially was that the organiser, Joanna Saville, who's the director of the Sydney International Food Festival, which will be held this October, contacted me to say, how can we get the regions more involved in the major Sydney International Food Festival? And I said, well, we're doing all this great stuff with 100-mile diets. What if we looked at sort of 100-mile circles and got people to create dishes from that region and then put those together in a meal? And we do one in our region and then we come to Sydney and we partner with the Sydney region. If enough people are asking the local independent shops to stock local food, and if people are asking more and more for local produce, eventually the supermarkets will have to have lines that say local produce from 100 miles, or, you know, there has to be a section. And we can actually have that impact by from the ground roots through consumer demand and creating awareness, that eventually the big guys will feel so threatened that they will start to look after some of our smaller producers.
And that's the New South Wales Rural Woman of the Year, Kim Curry.
It's a great idea. I just wish you could express it in kilometres rather than in miles.
I can. It is. It's 160.
It's 160
k's. 160 k's. And she says that's roughly 2 hours, a two-hour drive.
Yeah, it's such a clever idea, isn't it? Imagine how much, how much smaller the footprint would be. Imagine how much energy we would save in sort of delivering food and truck trips.
And think of all those, you know, sort of desperately poor food producers in Southeast Asia and other places who'd starve because we didn't buy their produce anymore.
I love my tropical fruit, and to the best of my knowledge, there's not much tropical fruit growing around Sydney. But I tell you what did make an impact on me was Sue Dodd, who used to work at Sydney Markets, mentioned years ago. She said buy seasonal produce.
Yes.
Because two things: one of which it's cheaper, and secondly, you know, it's really fresh. And since Sue mentioned this, that's what I do every time.
Yes, and it doesn't have to be stored or frozen.
There are some times of the year you shouldn't be able to buy grapes because they're just not produced. Other times there are.
What's slow food?
Justin, can you answer, John?
slow food, I always thought it's just the food sourced from not too far away.
Okay.
Is that right?
No, I think it's actually sort of, you know, slow cooked. I think it's slow cooked, slow prepared, slow eaten.
Maybe.
It's actually savouring of...
Instead of enjoying.
Savouring your food, perhaps.
Instead of just shoving stuff in your mouth and while you're watching
television. I think it's
television.
The opposite of fast food.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, of course. Okay.
And we know trucks take a long time to get through the city, and I guess you're relying on the truck to get the food to you. One of the things, Angela, which I'm sure our 702 listeners would be interested in, is that move by Kim to try and connect Sydney with the regions, particularly kind of educating them about where their food comes from. Because, I mean, if you're living in the centre of Sydney, it's often hard to know where on earth the food's coming from. So.
That's true, although there is an absolute blossoming in farmers' markets
in Hawkesbury, in particular. I think the figure I saw a couple of years ago was something like $1 billion worth of agricultural produce is produced in the Sydney basin each year.
Yeah, we've
got to watch
remarkable.
The nutritional value too. Apparently there's a study out in America showing that mass-produced food is losing its nutritional value because they're emphasising things like colour and size over vitamin content.
Imagine that, and uniformity and that sort of thing. Yeah. Very interesting. Thank you so much for bringing that story to the table, Justin.
Thank you.
And thank you all, in fact, for joining us this morning on Saturday Talk About. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you and to have all your stories. They've been very thought-provoking. James O'Brien, thank you.
Pleasure.
James O'Brien is the Content Director for 702 ABC Sydney. John Cleary, thank you.
Sunday nights will be fine.
He is the presenter. I'm sure you know that by now. And Justin Hunsdale, it's been a delight to have you on board too. Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Ange.
Justin Hunsdale is producer and presenter at the ABC Western Plains headquarters in Dubbo. Thank you so much for joining us on Saturday Talk About this morning. Coming up in just a few moments' time, we've got the midday news, and then I hope you'll stay tuned for Grandstand this afternoon. It's bound to be exciting, action-packed, and I'm sure there's bound to be plenty of football.
AFL this summer.
Is it AFL this summer?
Yeah, and Simone after the news.
Very good. Thank you, James. You see, you can tell he's the content director, can't you? Thanks for joining us. Enjoy your afternoon. Bye-bye now.